from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today in Capital Notes, we'll look at the national interests influencing the Wisconsin Supreme Court race. Then we'll learn what's happening at the NFL draft in Green Bay next month.
It's really turned into a fan festival, celebration of the game, and celebration of the cities that support the game. So it's been a long time coming, but we're really excited to have that celebration of the game of football here in Green Bay.
Plus, a local animator shares how he came to work at places like Pixar and DreamWorks.
From the very beginning, I was put down in front of a TV and saw animation and always loved it. Just thought, what is this magic? How is this happening?
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. We're about a week away from an election where Wisconsinites will vote for a new state Supreme Court justice. Here's WUWM's Mayan Silver exploring how people outside the state, like Elon Musk, are having an impact on this state election.
This is Capital Notes from Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mayan Silver, in conversation with J.R. Ross. He's editor of WizPolitics.com. Hi, J.R.
How's it going today?
It is good. Okay. So, of course, the state Supreme Court race is 1 week away. It's happening during Republican President Donald Trump's second term, his embrace of Elon Musk and Doge, and a right-wing agenda, which at the same time has arguably not inspired much sort of nationally driven Democratic pushback. So I guess I'm wondering, JR, can the Wisconsin Supreme Court election on April 1st be looked at as a referendum on these national developments or not really?
Partly yes, and definitely kind of a referendum on Elon Musk in an odd way. I mean, look, every race that I've covered in an off year like this one, there's some outside force that impacts it, whether it's the economy, who's in the White House. It's unique, though, to have Elon Musk to be such a person like him, be such a central figure. I mean, he's not an elected official, though he's kind of an aide to Donald Trump, right, leading this Doge effort. But here's a person who inspires a visceral reaction from Democrats. When you look at the polling, isn't really popular with independents. And he is spending north of $15 million, at least through his PACs, to help Brad Schimmel. His fingerprints are all over this race. And part of it on both sides is clear why. For Susan Crawford, they're trying to harness this energy among the Democratic base and get them to turn out, right? There's obviously some anger among Democrats, the base, that the party isn't doing enough nationally to push back against Trump. They allowed that continuing resolution to pass a little while ago to keep the government open rather than taking a stand against it. Like, they're angry. They want something to react to. Can Susan Crawford get them to channel that anger into votes for her come April 1st? Big question. Two, Donald Trump supporters have only proven so far they'll turn out when Donald Trump's on the ballot. If Republicans, though, can find a way to harness those folks and get them to turn out in an off-year election like the Supreme Court race, that could be the holy grail for them of a coalition in Wisconsin. So you're seeing Musk's group go out and target Trump voters, like these people who only turn out in November when Trump, of every 4 years, when Trump's on the ballot. Will they turn out? Can he change the electorate from a normal spring electorate to what looks like November of 2024? Huge question for Brad Schimmel.
Axios reported Friday that Musk's super PAC will pay Wisconsin voters $100 to sign a petition expressing their opposition to, quote, activist judges. As the Journal Sentinel writes, both Musk and President Donald Trump have complained about federal judges, you know, either blocking or delaying their efforts to slash and reform the federal government. What are the legal and political implications of this? How's it affecting the race?
Good question. He did something similar in the November election. There are people complained about it, but nobody stopped it. Look, if you look at the petition, the bigger thing from my takeaways that I've heard of from looking at this is that when you sign the petition, you turn over your name, email address, your home address, basically information that a group would need to target you to turn you out for election. The offer is good through 11:59 p.m. on April 1st, the day of the election. They're looking for conservatives to try and turn them out. Like, this is all part of the ground game of the turnout operation. Elon Musk is targeting those sympathetic voters, the conservative slash Trump cause, and trying to get them out for Brad Schimmel. That's kind of what's going on here.
Is it arguably an improper inducement? And if so, can anyone step in before the quote unquote damage or benefits, depending on which side you're looking at it, is done?
My standard line is I'm not an attorney and I don't play one on TV, so I can't tell you for sure if it's legal. I know people have complained about it. They've challenged it in other courts, in other states, something similar in Pennsylvania. A judge declined to block it. It was a similar setup. Sign a petition, get $100. Also, they do like a random draw. They did a drawing, a quote-unquote drawing for $1 million a day. Turned out that actually wasn't a random drawing. They were picking people I thought were suitable spokespeople for the PAC to award this money to, et cetera, et cetera. So my point is, it wasn't stopped by somebody else. Could it be stopped here? Possibly. You need a court to step in. We're in the winning days of the election. I'm not sure if there's enough time. Maybe somebody will, but we'll see.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are many issues at play in this race. There's abortion, collective bargaining, redistricting, the powers of the governor and attorney general. Brad Schimmel is, of course, the GOP-backed candidate in the race. He actually didn't sign on to lawsuits suing drug companies over the opioid epidemic when he was attorney general. What role is this playing in the race?
Kind of not a huge one. You've seen a little bit of like some knocks against Schimmel over that. The whole thing was there were these multiple lawsuits against opioid manufacturers, the opioid industry in general, over that crisis. Schimmel declined to sign to a lawsuit. He received a donation from people in the industry. It was an issue in his 2018 re-election bid that he lost to Josh Call. It hasn't really been a big issue, though, in this race in terms of the ads that we're seeing. The ads have been focused on public safety, abortion, issues like that. Now we're seeing the first ad from Schimmel about transgender issues. But really, it's been a crime-driven messaging in a lot of ways. And it's interesting about that is that Schimmel has focused on the sentences Crawford has handed out, especially with child sex offenders. That is a weakness for her, they believe, and they are gaining traction with voters on that. Crawford has pushed back and portrayed Schimmel as soft on crime as well, giving deals to, for example, a man whose attorney gave his campaign a donation, who'd been caught with child porn. She's kind of muddied the water a bit on the public safety issue. People I talk to think Schimmel still has an advantage there, but not necessarily an overwhelming one. Abortion, another big issue. People feel like that's a problem for Schimmel. Now we're seeing, again, the first ad that I saw end of last week about transgender stuff from a candidate, from Schimmel. That was an issue in the fall election. Is that going to be a big driver for people come April 1st? We'll see. What I've been told by folks is that that issue really is a base driver, really excites a conservative base. This is going to be a base-on-base election. What I mean by that is getting the core Democrats, core Republicans, people who are self-identified, they turn out almost all the time, getting them motivated and turning out, that's your key. The casual voter who comes out every 4 years for presidential election, not really your target audience. You're trying to get those people who are part of your base. This is an issue that excites that conservative base. Now, polling's also shown it turns off some people in the middle. Is it a driver for them? I'm not sure. But it's interesting to see that now is seeping into the messaging we're seeing this race. Again, as we try and see, can the two sides turn out their bases for an April 1st election?
And of course, millions have been spent in this race on both sides from inside and outside of Wisconsin. It's the most expensive judicial race in our nation's history, breaking the record of our state's 2023 state Supreme Court election. But I have a question. Until the 2015 rewrite of our campaign finance law, billionaires could only have spent $10,000 to try to influence the outcome of this race. Can you explain how the change is affecting this race?
So what happened was there were a series of court decisions years ago that made Swiss cheese of Wisconsin's campaign finance laws. One of those laws limited donors in general to $10,000 per year to everybody, candidates, political parties, the whole nine yards. There was never a cap on donations to political parties. However, because of that limit on donations in general, it acted as a de facto cap for what you'd give to political parties, right? What happened was in 2015, Republicans rewrote campaign finance laws because they basically were a shamble after the court decisions and had all kinds of issues. And they wrote them to allow unlimited transfer or limited contributions to all the parties, but also add unlimited transfers to political candidates. That's where you've seen, you know, George Soros and J.B. Pritzker and folks like that give big donations to the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, and then the party's transferred money to Susan Crawford. Likewise, on the Republican side, Diane Hendricks, Liz and Dick Uihlein, all business people, they've made big donations to the Republican Party, who's then transferred money to Schimmel. Why that's important is it has allowed Susan Crawford in particular to put up now some $23 million on TV, according to Ad Impact, which is a service that tracks advertising. That is unusual for a candidate, to say the least, in a three-month race, essentially. That is not happening by raising $20,000 a pop, the maximum donation from a donor. That is because of these big donations that go to the party and to the candidate. That's a big advantage for her because the Republicans don't do that as frequently. They do it a little bit, and Schimmel's around $9, $10 million on TV. They select their outside groups more for TV ads. The thing is, keep in mind, though, is all the spending going on, candidates get a better rate on TV ads, broadcast ads, than groups do. So when the money flows through Crawford, she can have more ads or a higher volume of ads for less money than the other side. So if I look at what's being spent, there's an advantage for Schimmel right now in terms of overall spending. But in terms of those gross ratings points, those frequency, those ads being shown, Crawford has an advantage as the final 2 weeks because of how it's being spent. That's an example of how the money is, how things have changed in the last 10 years on that rewrite of campaign finance laws. Now, the outside spending, other outside spending, that would have been impacted by that law. That would still, you'd still see your outside groups doing stuff. It's really the big change is how the money flows from donor to political party to candidate. That has changed dramatically compared to 10 years ago.
Thanks so much for weighing in, JR, and thanks for all this information and for joining me on Capital Notes.
Anytime.
You can hear Capital Notes every other Monday on Lake Effect. And if you want to learn more about this election, make sure to check out WUWM's podcast, Swing State of the Union. This season is all about the state Supreme Court, and the final episode out this Wednesday looks at the candidates in this race. You can find that wherever you get your podcasts. Neighborhood Improvement Districts, also known as NIDs or NIDs, are a way for communities to band together to support community projects. They're organizations that have official recognition from local governments, and they're not without controversy. These groups are allowed to levy money from property owners, an issue that came to light during a recent effort to create a NID in Milwaukee's River West neighborhood. Reporter Carmela DeQuisto wrote about the effort in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. She joins me now to talk about it. Carmela, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
What can you do with something like an NID or BID that might otherwise be difficult to do as, you know, your average neighborhood group, your kind of unaffiliated neighborhood group?
Well, certainly large-scale projects. I mean, big restorations of commercial or private property. And I also think things that are kind of harder on an individual basis or within a small group are things that happen consistently. So even something like shoveling or plowing efforts, something like garbage pickup, that is repeated week to week or day to day or month to month or whatever. You know, effort could fizzle, schedules can get busy, people can burn out. And with the funds there, we don't have to rely on these small groups and individuals to make the effort to improve the neighborhood.
Now, your piece really looks at a specific effort, but I'm going to look at just overall. Mm-hmm. What is the process of creating an NID? What are the kinds of steps that people have to take?
So it is a very long process, and there's probably over 20 steps that you have to take. But essentially, a group of people work with the Department of City Development. They have to get a number of signatures. There are a lot of education efforts. There's a lot of marketing efforts. There's things like mailings that have to go out at a certain date. And there's also a really specific cadence to it. There's a timeliness. And that was actually one of the issues with the River West NID, was they were on this really specific schedule. And kind of by the time that word got out to all the neighbors, there was a 24-hour window where they'd have to spend upwards of $30,000 to send out this mailing. So overall, there are a lot of steps, and it has to be done in this really specific order and in this really timely way. But it can be anyone. It could be any group of people in kind of a specific pain point with this River West NID was that you don't need a vote. It doesn't need to be consensus. It could be just any group of people with enough signatures can work with the city and enact a NID.
As you're alluding to, there was there have been some issues with the River West NID. Where did the idea for it really originate? And who is the group of people who have been trying to, you know, push this forward?
Sure. Well, this most recent attempt at a NID, the idea, I believe, was bouncing between neighborhood activist Ruth Wheel and the late Alderman Brostoff. He wanted to start a business improvement district on Locust Street, so from Locust from Humboldt to Holton. But there was an issue. I think too many of the buildings were mixed use, something like that. It just logistically wasn't working out. But there was enthusiasm about the idea in general. He really wanted something for the neighborhood. And he and Ruth went back and forth with some ideas. Ruth went to the director of Riverworks Corporation, where she works. And I believe he floated the idea of kind of an arts and culture based neighborhood improvement district, and that's where it kind of evolved. They got a temporary board of neighbors that were enthusiastic about the idea. They kind of started the process with the city, and those were the folks that brought it to the attention of the neighborhood last summer.
What have been the obstacles that they've faced with creating this?
You know, talking with Ruth, timing was a huge issue for this group. As I mentioned earlier, there's a really specific cadence of action you have to do to get one of these neighborhood improvement districts enacted. And by the time that Riverworks made the big social media announcement that blew up and got everybody really involved, there was just not enough time left to do the kind of educating the neighborhood wanted and make sure everybody felt pretty secure about this decision before moving forward. So I think timing was huge, or lack of time, rather, was huge. And she also mentioned kind of lack of education, so not enough opportunities to really share the benefits of what a neighborhood improvement district could do. So that was my understanding of the challenges on their end. And then I think a lot of people were really against moving forward with that. So I think if they were to move forward with it, which they could without overall approval from the neighborhood, they would be fighting a really long uphill battle with some of the residents.
Well, it seems like at least part of the pushback is the amount of money that people would be paying. Can you get into that a bit?
Yeah, that was certainly a big issue. So it's basically an additional property tax. Each neighborhood improvement district is kind of assessed differently. And the proposed assessment for River West was based on property type. So it was $50 a year for each residential unit with a cap of 10 units. So even if it's, you know, a 20 or 30 unit apartment building, there was that cap, which was an issue. And then I believe commercial properties were $125 a year. So essentially, they'd be working with something, I have the number, $260,000 a year, not including the admin costs, to kind of bring this vision to life. So a lot of people thought $50 a year for my neighborhood to, you know, maybe be more visible for bikers or trash cleanup or murals. Like, there were plenty of people that were completely in for that relatively low-cost way to improve their neighborhood, but River West is a mixed income neighborhood, and there are a lot of people on fixed incomes. And that was also right after the MPS referendum passed. And so people were already going to see a hike in their taxes that we didn't have an idea of how high that would be at the time. And so there was a lot of fear about this extra cost, and especially that this cost could go up year to year. There wasn't a cap. There was nothing kind of keeping it at $50, and it would change as the neighborhood changes. So there were plenty of people that voiced their concern about it, and rightfully so.
Now, as we look to the future, it seems like there is still interest among some to have either an NID or a BID. Mm-hmm. What is that future path looking like, given the necessity to have, you know, very specific steps taken, but also this pushback from some in the community?
Yeah. It's notable, too, that 10 years ago, another group of neighbors tried to start a NID, and it was also squashed down. So I think there's a lot of resistance to this more kind of formal organization. But there was a once thriving neighborhood association that kind of fizzled 2019-2020 time that I think, based on what I heard at the town hall, was a decent way of moving forward with some sort of compromise between nothing and then the NID. So that would just be kind of an at-will, join if you want, donate if you can, plan of attack for improving the neighborhood. I know the Riverworks Development Corporation also just jump-started the River West Business Association. So that was another association that had kind of, I don't know if it completely dissolved, but it just kind of interest went way down in 2020. I mean, I think businesses had a lot on their plate, obviously. There is bigger fish to fry. But that association just started having meetings and growing interest again in December. So I see that as another great path forward for some development in the neighborhood.
All right. Well, we will see what the future holds. Thank you so much for joining us right here on Lake Effect.
Thank you.
Carmela DeQuisto is a freelance reporter with Milwaukee Magazine. Her article on the River West NID was featured in this month's magazine. At WUWM.com, you can find our previous conversations with Milwaukee Magazine writers. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Later in the show, we'll hear from a local animator with his advice for people interested in working at a place like Pixar. But first, Green Bay is hosting the NFL Draft next month. We'll tell you all about what's happening at the event and help you plan a trip to experience it for yourself. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. This year's NFL Draft is coming to Wisconsin. Green Bay will host the event from Thursday, April 24th through the 26th. Last year's draft in Detroit broke the NFL's attendance record, with more than 700,000 people flocking to the city. That could mean big business for Green Bay and surrounding communities. There will be tons of people traveling from out of state to attend. But you can also check out the draft for yourself. Nick Meisner is the Vice President of Digital Marketing and Communications with Discover Green Bay. Amanda Weibel is the Communications Officer with Travel Wisconsin. They join Lake Effect's Becky Mortensen to help you plan a trip to the draft.
What it used to be is just a meeting of the owners to pick the new round of players. And there wasn't much fanfare around it at all. And now it's turned into an annual fan appreciation celebration of football. Of course, the core purpose of the draft is for all the teams to select their new players from their colleges and be introduced to their fan base. But it's really turned into a fan festival, celebration of the game and celebration of the cities that support the game. So it's been a long time coming, but we're really excited to have that celebration of the game of football here in Green Bay.
Can you tell me how Green Bay came to be the host of this year's draft?
That's another great story, actually. So the process of getting the NFL draft here predates me and really all kind of is because of the team that was here at the time, which is our CEO, Brad Toll, our vice president of sales, Beth Ulitowski, the team over at the Packers, including Mark Murphy and Aaron Popke. They've been going after this bid for 8, 9 years. And in fact, it goes back to when they first moved it. And our president and CEO, Brad, called over to Aaron over at the Packers and said, hey, they're moving this thing around. Radio City Music Hall holds 6,000 people. The Resh holds 8 or 9. Let's bring this thing here. And of course, it's not an 8 or 9,000 person event anymore. But the bid process, we bid for a few of the events. And really the thing that tipped the scales in our favor was the development and the support of the Resh Expo Center, which is our brand new exposition space that is state-of-the-art pillarless space. Without that being built, the draft would have never came to Green Bay. We wouldn't have had the facility to do it there in front of Lambeau Field. The Resh Expo was really the final pin in the lock that unlocked the ability for Green Bay to host the draft. So it's been a long process, a lot of development, a lot of things going up here in Green Bay that led to it. But overall, it was just a bid process through the NFL. And after a few tries, we got it here.
The draft is about a month away. So let's help people who want to attend plan their trip. What are people in town for the draft going to be able to do here?
Oh, there's so much going on. And really, we're focusing on the stuff around the shoulder time of the events. All over, not just Green Bay, but in the downtown area, in Ashwaubenon, where the draft is being held, in De Pere and Howard and Oneida, all of these places are planning some sort of events to bring excitement to the fans before the draft opens. Obviously, once the draft opens at noon on Thursday and noon on Friday, we want to see everyone at Lambeau Field at the draft footprint. But in between there, we're talking everything from fan festivals to food truck rallies to concerts and live events, just all sorts of stuff going on. And it can all be found on greenbay.com/draft25.
And there's this NFL draft experience. What can you tell me about that?
The NFL draft experience is really the fan festival of football that I was talking about. It's going to have everything from a Packers Everywhere dive bar exhibit to punt, pass, and kick competitions to sponsor engagements, autograph stages, Vince Lombardi trophy installations. You can see every single one of the Super Bowl trophies, NFL lockers, so exhibits of what an NFL locker looks like from all 32 teams. Just so much going on in the experience that we're excited to share.
Talked about autographs. Will people have a chance to see or interact with the players in any way?
Yeah, there are autograph tents for sure. And they do rotate that out. Sometimes it's prospects, current players, legends. But there's usual multiple autograph stages. But then also all of the sponsors bring in some sort of player appearances from time to time as well. So there's lots of player engagement opportunities.
All right, now let's talk some logistics. I imagine there are going to be a lot of people in town and the surrounding area. So talk about getting to the action. What are some options going to be for people?
Well, the beauty of a big event in Green Bay, you have to drive through the entire beautiful state of Wisconsin to get here. So you're going to get to see the whole thing, right? From the lakeshore of Sheboygan down to the urban hub of Milwaukee, through the Fox Cities, Manitowoc, Fond du Lac. There's so much of Wisconsin to see, and we're excited to show the entire state off. But that being said, a lot of those destinations from Milwaukee to Wausau, all the way up to Marinette, are planning fan shuttles. So check with those convention visitors bureaus and the hotels around those areas to see if they are planning shuttles. Otherwise, there's plenty of places to stay in Green Bay as well. We're working with the Tavern League on a shuttle service that'll run 40 sprinter vans around the area. The Green Bay Metro will be running it. And then, of course, just like any Packers game day, there'll be tons of parking in residents and yards and businesses around the footprint.
All right, Amanda, there's going to be lots of people from out of town visiting Green Bay. If they wanted to check out the food scene there, where would you recommend they go?
Green Bay's dining scene is fantastic. You are going to discover really an eclectic mix of flavors and tastes when you visit. One restaurant to check out is Cedar and Sage Grill House, which is located in the Oneida Casino. Many of the dishes celebrate Native American cuisine and are made from locally sourced ingredients, including ingredients from the Oneida Nation. I recommend checking out the Bison Pot Roast, and that's served with the Oneida White Cornbread and the Three Sisters, which is a vegetable dish that combines corn, beans, and squash. If you're interested in some Irish flavors, make sure to make a stop at St. Brendan's Inn. This hotel operates as an Irish pub, so it's a ton of fun. It's a great atmosphere, and you can savor traditional and contemporary Irish dishes. And another classic spot to stop at in Green Bay is Al's Hamburgers. They have been in business for 91 years. So it's that classic burger joint where you can get your burgers, fries, shakes, and more.
So the draft, right, is the big draw here, but there's lots of other stuff to do in Green Bay. So Amanda, what are some other things you would recommend people check out while they're in the area?
You are so right, Becky. There is so much to see and do in Green Bay, and there are a ton of events planned in the area surrounding the draft activities. Nick mentioned some of them earlier, but you know, there's live music like the Draft City Music Festival and many, many others. It's also a great opportunity to visit one of the area's other iconic attractions that you've always wanted to go to. So the Green Bay Botanical Garden might be a great change of pace to really step away from it all and go on a stroll. It's a 47-acre property that's home to over 120,000 plants. The new zoo and adventure park is a great option for families. You can learn about animals from North America and all over the world. And another great place to visit in Green Bay is the National Railroad Museum. There you can discover more than 70 one-of-a-kind train cars. They also have a rotating lineup of special exhibits and a growing collection of historic artifacts. So there's so much to do. You are not going to be able to squeeze it all in during your draft trip, but it's a perfect reason to plan a return trip to Green Bay.
And Amanda, I understand that Travel Wisconsin is doing a sweepstakes for the draft. What can you tell me about that?
Well, we know that the draft is going to be full of epic moments. So Travel Wisconsin is offering a trip with the epic experiences to match. The Travel Wisconsin Dream Draft Sweepstakes is in partnership with ESPN Radio's Unsportsmanlike program, and it runs through March 31st. 10 lucky winners and a guest are going to get to go on this exclusive trip. It starts with overnight accommodations in Milwaukee and then a VIP bus trip that's going to take you to Green Bay for the first day of the draft. It also includes a curated stop in Kohler along the way. But once you arrive in Green Bay, the sweepstakes winners are going to receive some VIP hospitality at the Tundra Trio, which are the homes right next to Lambeau Field, and get an exclusive meet and greet with the hosts of ESPN's Radio Unsportsmanlike program. And again, get to experience all of the draft activities that are available. The sweepstakes is open to people 21 and older from eligible states, and you can enter by visiting travelwisconsin.com/draft.
So the draft has been held in cities like Chicago, New York, and Los Angeles, but it is coming to the small but mighty Green Bay, Wisconsin this year. So for both of you, what does it say about the city that it'll be hosting such a big event?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a little bit of a misconception regarding the size of the city. You know, we are the smallest professional sports market, but we are a professional sports market. You know, our hundreds of thousands of residents and in and around the metro area bring a level of culture and cuisine, like Amanda was talking about, and entertainment options that, you know, I think get lost a lot because it's like, yeah, it's the smallest professional sports market. But I think that can draw connotations of us actually being smaller than we are. In fact, you know, we hear it all the time here, like we had people had no idea that Green Bay was as eclectic, diverse. So, you know, I think comparing when you put us next to a Chicago or, you know, Philadelphia, yeah, it'll be a different experience, but the history, the city, everyone here is extremely welcoming. And, you know, I think it's going to be a great experience.
Yeah. And I would add the draft is really showing that Wisconsin deserves to be on the big stage. You know, huge kudos to Discover Green Bay and the Green Bay Packers who have worked so hard to put on what is sure to be an amazing event. And we get to leverage. It's this all eyes on us moment that is going to leave a lasting impression of Wisconsin. It's an opportunity to share why Wisconsin is such a special place. You know, football might have been the thing that made Green Bay quite famous, but folks are going to be wowed by other experiences in Wisconsin. They're going to discover something unexpected, whether it's Wisconsin's welcoming hospitality, our spirited nature, our natural beauty, our fresh spin on food and drink. It's such a great opportunity for people to make memories and give folks a reason to come back and explore more.
All right. Well, Amanda and Nick, thank you so much for joining me for Wandering Wisconsin.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us. It was super fun.
Nick Meisner is the Vice President of Digital Marketing and Communications with Discover Green Bay. Amanda Weibel is the Communications Officer with Travel Wisconsin. They both spoke with Lake Effect's Becky Mortensen for our travel series, Wandering Wisconsin. We've got a new season of Bubbler Talk, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. After a break, a Milwaukee animator shares how he made his childhood dreams into a career and gives advice to others who want to work as animators. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. How would you like to be an animator for Pixar, DreamWorks, or Disney? To some, it's a dream job. Aaron Notstein worked at those companies and is now running his own animation studio based in Milwaukee with a partner in California. Tomorrow, he'll be leading a tea at the LEC, or Lubar Entrepreneurship Center, at UW-Milwaukee. People who attend will have a chance to network and do 2D, 3D, and stop-motion animation. Here he is speaking with WUWM's Mayan Silver.
I started off with a shoebox, and my mom made it for me. It had two pencils, unsharpened, one at the top, one at the bottom, and we taped a paper roll. And I could draw one and then crinkle up the pencil, and the next picture would come up. And it wasn't quite 24 frames per second, but it was allowing me to create a little scroll of a picture story of something that I can't spell, but I have a, you know, what are probably now look like squiggles, but it's a robot squiggle, and it's saving the town, and it's, oh, it's, here's the bad guy that's come in.
Wait, so you weren't even just drawing regular cartoon images? You were actually trying to do some animation, like, as a kid?
Oh, yeah. From the very beginning, I was put down in front of a TV and saw animation and always loved it. Just thought, what is this magic? How is this happening? And someone was like, well, they didn't, you know, it's not real, it's not filmed. And it's like, what? What does that mean then? How did they get it? What do you mean it wasn't filmed? Who came up with, oh, someone drew it. Someone drew it? Who is this person? And then you see them, and they're a cartoon of life, and you're like, what the? This is a Hogwarts for real. This is a magical person who can do stuff and gets paid for it? Why wouldn't everyone try to have that feeling of, what a gift, what a joy that this is a real place for someone to operate from? But you're also, you know, a very cartoonist person who goes, yeah, that's what I'll do. You know, it's not very, like, straight and narrow. It's very, you're going to go on a very winding path.
Right. So what was your path?
Oh, started off school at North Carolina School of the Arts, and it was the first year of the animation program. So we had no alumni. We literally transformed a broom closet into our studio. And there were brooms and mops in the corners for until I graduated. And so they told us to kind of keep our hopes down. And you're going to be the first wave through. And I told them I wanted to work at Pixar and DreamWorks and Sony. And they were like, keep your expectations down. You're the first one out. You don't know anybody. And I had three teachers who really just believed in me and said, you know, bump all that. You swing. When you get up to bat, you take a swing. You apply. You apply. You apply. You apply. And I applied 16 times to get into Pixar. And I have 16 rejection letters that I have printed out and I keep
nice.
In
there.
And the thing, and they're all copy-paste. They're
oh,
not even
wow.
personalized. They're,
that's amazing.
Entry number 1,100 and, you know, blah, blah, blah. No, I'm not a special denial. The 17th time, my last time as a senior, because I had started working at all these other places to impress Pixar, I finally got in. And that's when people don't ask about the 16 times. They go, you got in?
Amazing. It's all about the resilience then, hey?
Yeah.
And trying to increase your portfolio, which is one of the things that you're talking about at this event that's coming
yes.
up
yes.
on Tuesday.
Tea at the LEC, March 25th. Tiara Hammond is setting up a great event. I mean, the whole LEC team, a bunch of people that you want to meet to help set up your companies, your businesses. It, you know, if I could go back and talk to myself at five and give myself some advice, and someone says they want to be an artist when they're five, and this event is for five-year-olds, if it's for adults who want to take it, it's for students primarily, but if you have a young one and you're like, they really like this, like, could it be something? Yes. Yes, it could. Here's how. Here's this program that's being born at the LEC that's merging the Peck School and the business school for artists who want to think about, well, maybe I don't want to move to California. I'd like to stay local. How can I do that? How can I take ownership of my own artwork? How can I not go and work at a company and retain no royalties? A lot of times with animators, because the union broke in the 40s, thank you, Walter Elias Disney, the residual income is not even possible. A lot of the unions who went on strike in LA, writers recently, it's over increasing their residuals. Animators have none to begin with. And the idea of asking for some is a non-starter for deals. So how do you as an artist navigate this world that is gig to gig and that, you know, comes with a lot of mysticism? How do you navigate it? Do you set up a company? Do you work for yourself? This is taking all of the experience that isn't just at the big studios, but then after I left those studios and I started making my own content and I started marketing myself. The biggest fear for animators is not even doing the work. It's promoting it. It's saying, hey, I have something. Would you like to see it? Because that potential vulnerability of, oh God, are you going to hate it? Are you going to not be interested? But I want to, but how do I, and how, and where do I go?
So the people that are going to come to this Lubar Center's tea at the LEC, there's going to be some discussion about 2D, 3D, and stop motion animation. Like, in a nutshell, what's the difference between those three types?
If you're a filmmaker, you're most accustomed to working with your hands in stop motion. That's the easiest. If you're a filmmaker, I'm already used to working on a set. I've got actual lights, actual cameras, actual things in front of me. 3D is predominantly computer-based, so you're on your computer all day. 2D, you can go super digital. A lot of people, you know, draw on their iPads, tablets, on their computers. But it's also something that, especially in the early stages, you're writing on paper, you can go analog, you can unplug for a little while, and then before kind of getting into the production and post-production parts of it. But we'll also be talking about the entrepreneurship behind, as an animator, you're never just a 3D animator or a stop-motion animator or a 2D animator. I've worked on all three kinds of mediums. And the idea of giving a spirit to something is what an animator does, whether it's with a puppet, whether it's with a, you know, a hand puppet that, or a, you know, 3D character or a stop motion.
Claymation or.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Jeffrey Katzenberg just gave a sobering report, opinion, I don't know, about 80 to 90% of the jobs at these big studios being obsolete with AI. And that's a sobering kind of reality. But the response to that is that you don't need to apply for those jobs. You can come to the Entrepreneur Center, the LEC, and not only get a great arts education, but you can also learn how to operate it as your own business. It's taking the everything in animation needs to be done in California and saying it can happen right here in Milwaukee.
What is that animation scene in Milwaukee?
I think of it as, I read a book to my daughter called The Seven Blind Mice, and it's the orange one goes over to the tusk and says, it's a spear. And the red one goes over to the tail and says, it's a rope. And the other one goes over to the ears and says, it's a fan. And finally, one of them goes through all of them and goes, oh, it's an elephant. And the Milwaukee animation scene is all of those parts exist. And we keep saying, well, you can only be an elephant in California. And meanwhile, Milwaukee is an elephant that doesn't realize it yet. It hasn't had the, wait, so if so-and-so was here, why would we need to? That's right. We don't need to. It's here. We're an elephant.
So in non-metaphorical terms, though, what's the elephant in Milwaukee? It's got, there's resources at UWM. There's resources elsewhere.
Yes.
What
Yes.
What would you say they are?
UWM is such a fantastic resource itself. It's teachers. The Peck School of the Arts is, if you've ever been to the fourth floor there, it's beautiful. Their equipment, their sound stages are state of the art. Like it's, UWM was also ranked in Hollywood Reporter's top 25 schools a couple of years ago. So it's at this threshold of greatness. And I really want to participate in it. I want to throw my hat in the ring and help out because it's bigger than me. It's bigger than any one person, but it's so exciting that I would want to remind people, because we're not starting anything. We're reminding people how much is already here. And, you know, if I were to say, oh, I wanted to come in here and create one big studio in Milwaukee, it would be an insult because there are actually a lot of smaller studios here that I would be ignoring, which isn't kind to them. But it would also be missing the potential of, through these programs, creating something that can build 12 studios. And they're artist-driven, so they're not these, you know, evil corporate mean to artists. They're by the artists, for the artists. And create 12 different studios, create 120 studios, create so many studios is ridiculous. But to realize that Milwaukee is growing and it's not in want of anything other than that moment of, oh, wait, we do have everything here.
So do you think that if you were like going to choose some personality traits that would make you a successful animator overall, do you know what that would be?
This, again, is a great question, and I'm already kicking myself in the future for not having a great reply here. If you have a disproportionate amount of pain tolerance, inner pain tolerance, if you can deal with frustration and keep going, animation's a glove. It fits like a glove. If you can endure it,
Totally. You know, your story, you were talking about how you had applied 16 times to Pixar and finally on the 17th time you got accepted after doing a whole lot of work to get there.
Yeah.
But there was a, like NPR, I'm pretty sure it was NPR, did a story about a cartoonist that was trying to get a cartoon into The New Yorker. Do you know that story?
No, I don't.
He literally, I don't remember what the exact number was, but it was like 200 some odd times that he had submitted cartoons to The New Yorker, and finally he got an acceptance after like,
wow,
yeah, 218 times or something like that.
And now he's a cartoonist.
Yeah,
animator.
Now he's a published New Yorker cartoonist. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's that resilience. It's that impenetrable optimism, potentially, I guess, is what you could say, right?
Yeah, it's very penetrable, but it's very it grows back. I'll say that sometimes when I get into like a technical point and I'm using Blender or something and I just reach a point where I go, I don't know how to do this, I will allow myself to quit for the night. I'm quitting. I get to be very dramatic, and then in the morning I go, all right, I'll start up again. I'll try it again this way, but I allow myself that big. That's it. I quit.
Yeah, there you go. You need those breaks. You got to be good for yourself. I think that's a lesson for no matter what your career is, like you need rest. You can't just like plow forward all the time. Do you have like a favorite Pixar or like a favorite cartoon? I just want to give a shout out to one of my favorite ones, Jerry's Game from 1997.
Oh, yes.
It features an elderly man named Jerry playing a game of chess against himself in a park, and it won an Oscar.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a good one.
I loved WALL-E. That opening first 30 minutes with almost no dialogue, I think rewired in a really cool way all of the potential of what you can do with animation as a story and as a medium for telling a story. So shout out Andrew Stanton on that one.
Nice. I got to see that. I've never seen it.
WALL-E?
Can you believe it?
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, it's a gem. I never want, when people say, I haven't seen this or I haven't read this, it's not a point of like, you're a bad person. it's a, what a treat you have in store for you. What a piece of dark chocolate you've saved for yourself for later on to say, I'm waiting for the right moment to crack open my Wall-E for the first time.
Totally. Yes. Or your Jerry's table.
Yes.
For that matter. Jerry's game.
Jerry's game
for that matter. Yes. Love it. Awesome. Well, Aaron Nodstein, thank you so much for chatting with us on Lake Effect.
Thank you so much for having me.
Aaron Nodstein is a Milwaukee-based animator. He'll lead the Tea at the LEC event at UWM tomorrow evening. Ahead of that, he spoke with WUWM's Mayan Silver. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll hear from Judge Susan Crawford, one of the candidates for the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And we'll have a non-interview with candidate Judge Brad Schimmel, analyzing his stated positions and asking the questions that remain. We'll look at how special education in Wisconsin is being impacted by federal cuts. Plus, we'll learn what's in Milwaukee Rec's Spring Activities Guide. Thank you so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.